Hello and welcome back. The basic premise behind this lecture is that both long-distance trade and long-distance travel were widespread in antiquity. Trade and travel are important at the beginning of our course for three reasons. First, whenever an exchange took place between the Greeks and the Romans and other Mediterranean peoples, an exchange between cultures also took place. And as a result of that exchange, a little bit of each culture rubbed off against the other. And sometimes not just a little bit, but a whole lot, as in the case of Greek contact with the Phoenicians, which we'll be talking about in some detail. Second, exchanges were taking place throughout the period covered by our course among virtually all Mediterranean-based cultures, often involving huge distances. Indeed, exchanges were taking place several millennia before our course begins, as early as the mid-8th century BC. The archaeologist Albert Ammerman has recently claimed to have found evidence of what he calls voyaging foragers who were sailing from the Turkish mainland to the east coast of Cyprus in Neolithic times, when man was still a hunter-gatherer, to be precise, about 10,000 years BC. They were doing so to obtain the rich deposits of salt that were to be found on the Cypriot shore. Interestingly, Ammerman also claims that the spread of agriculture moved across the regions bordering the Mediterranean from east to west at the rate of 1 kilometer per year. A few thousand years later, but still in the Neolithic era, the volcanic island of Melos, one of the so-called Cycladic islands in the Aegean, began exporting obsidian. Obsidian was used for manufacturing both tools and weapons, such as arrows and spears. The third reason is that very few of the cultures that grew up around the Mediterranean were entirely self-sufficient, or if they were self-sufficient to begin with, they didn't remain self-sufficient indefinitely. Either increase in population made them dependent on essential imports such as grain, or increasing sophistication created an appetite for imported luxury goods. The backdrop to this lecture is the Mediterranean itself, Mare Nostrum, our sea, as the Romans called this body of water, which is almost completely surrounded by land. It covers an area close to 1 million square miles, and it's the largest inland sea in the world. It's also very salty, much more salty than the Atlantic, for instance, due to evaporation, which exceeds the rainfall. Conventionally, geographers subdivide it into a number of smaller seas, the Tyrrhenian Sea off the west coast of Italy, the Adriatic off the east coast, the Ionian off the west coast of Greece, and the Aegean off the east. Probably the commodities that were transported in largest quantity, not only by the Greeks and Romans, but also by other seafaring Mediterranean peoples in antiquity, were wine, olive oil, grain, and pottery. The most common form of commercial container was a two-handled jar with a narrow neck known as an amphora. Amphora is actually the Latin form of the Greek word amphoreus, meaning carried on both sides. Amphoras varied greatly in size, though the average capacity in classical and Hellenistic times was 4.5 to 5.5 gallons. The pottery type seems to have been invented by the Canaanites, who lived in the coastal area of what later became Syria and Palestine. Egyptian tomb paintings of the 14th century BC already depict Canaanite prisoners of war transporting amphoras to the pharaoh's storehouse. The Egyptians adopted the shape and used it for the storage of wine and were also the first to impress stamps on amphoras, perhaps for quality control purposes. Amphoras are referred to in Linear B tablets, the syllabary of the Mycenaean Greeks, and they are also mentioned in the poems of Homer. We'll be talking about the Mycenaeans in a later lecture. They were trading in the Mediterranean as early as 1600 BC. Amphoras were used for the transporting not only of wine, but also of olive oil, dried fish, pitch, and water. They're extremely useful for our understanding of ancient trading patterns because of the stamps which are found on the handles, the rim, the neck, or the stopper of the vessel, and which frequently reveal their provenance and their date. Some 40,000 amphora handles have been found in Athens alone and 90,000 in Alexandria in the Nile Delta, making these cities the largest importers of wine, though not all amphoras would have contained wine, as I mentioned. It's estimated that ordinary merchant vessels could carry 3,000 and larger vessels up to 10,000 of these containers. They continued in use into Roman times, in fact, right up until the 6th century AD, which means that they were being used as commercial containers for over 2,000 years. So, to the subject of trade. There are a couple of important points to get across at the beginning. Number one, all traders conducted their business primarily by sea, even though sea travel was only relatively safe for 6 months of the year at most, roughly from late March to late September. And two, most of the goods that moved around the Mediterranean were in the hands of professional traders. Governments took very little initiative, and that's as true of the Roman era as it is of the Greek era. One of the earliest, perhaps the earliest, Mediterranean peoples to engage in long-distance trade on a large scale were a Semitic people known as the Phoenicians. The Phoenician port of Byblos, modern Jubail, in Lebanon, was already known to the Egyptians in the early dynastic period, that is to say, in the first half of the 3rd millennium BC. The Phoenicians traded especially in textiles, metals, foodstuffs, craft goods, and purple dye. They established trading posts in both the eastern and western Mediterranean from Spain to the Red Sea, though it's important to note that they did not penetrate the hinterland and trade on land. Herodotus even tells us that they sailed around Africa and re-entered the Mediterranean through the Straits of Gibraltar. The Phoenicians will reappear in our story later, since their greatest city, Carthage, in modern-day Tunisia, was destined to be involved in a life-and-death struggle with Rome. When Greeks, mainly Euboeans and other islanders, Euboea is a large island to the east of Attica, where Athens is, when they established Almina at the mouth of the Orontes River in northern Syria, a little before 800 BC, to be a trading post, or the Greek word emporion, they began trading with the Phoenicians. Almina, by the way, was not the only trading post that the Greeks established in this era. As we'll see in the next lecture, they also established one in the west at Pithecusi, modern Ischia, in the Bay of Naples. And in the course of their trading at Almina, the Greeks came to appreciate the advantages of the Phoenician, that is, Semitic alphabet, which they took over and adapted to their own purposes by adding the vowel sounds A, E, I, O, and U. The ensuing Orientalizing period, as we call it, which roughly lasted from 725 to 625 BC, named because of the impact of Eastern ideas introduced as a result of trade, was a time of enormous cultural development for the Greeks. Oriental motifs, astronomical and mathematical data, legal concepts, medical ideas, all of these now became part of the trade that entered the mind of Greece. We should note too that the Greek colonization movement, so-called, colonization isn't quite the right term, but we have no better one for it, conventionally dated 734 to 580 BC, was largely fueled by, first, the need for land brought about by overpopulation, and two, the opportunities for commercial undertakings that were intended to promote social advancement. Yet, despite the importance of trade for the Greeks, we encounter considerable prejudice against traders in early Greek literature. For instance, when Odysseus arrives at the court of the Phaeacians in Homer's Odyssey, a nobleman abuses him for looking like a down-at-heel merchant skipper who roves the high seas with an eye for grabbing as much gold as he can. And similarly, the epic poet Hesiod, roughly Homer's contemporary, expresses disdain for the one who, I quote, turns his foolish mind to trade, and for those wretches for whom, I quote again, money is equivalent to the breath of life, which is a chilling definition of the full-time merchant. Well, the word I've translated as breath of life is psuche, and that's the same word later used for the soul in Christian writings. Only a man who needs to escape from impoverishment and debt would, in Hesiod's view, be mad enough to commit himself to a life at sea, since the risk of losing one's cargo is high and nothing is worse than death by drowning. However, Hesiod does concede that it may be necessary for a farmer to offload the surplus of his grain crop by getting into a boat and sailing down the coast. Homer is recording the attitude of an aristocrat, whereas Hesiod is speaking on behalf of moderately prosperous peasants. So together they give us a pretty broad social perspective. In the words of Paul Cartledge, each in his way was waging an ideological polemic against the development of professional trading and traders. Around 600 BC, however, the social and economic status of traders seems to have improved. The historian Herodotus tells us, in particular, of a trader by the name of Sostratus of Aegina. Aegina is an island in the Aegean about 30 miles southwest of Athens. And Herodotus, who was the author of an account of the Persian Wars, is himself a fascinating figure in the history of early travel. He was probably the most widely traveled Greek of his generation, if not of any generation. He was born in Halicarnassus, modern Bodrum, on the coast of Turkey, and he visited Babylon, the Black Sea region, Egypt, and Phoenicia. His history is, in a sense, the first travel book in the Western tradition. But back to Sostratus. Sostratus was Mr. Moneybags. No one could compare with him in wealth, according to Herodotus, and his wealth was derived from trade. Well, in 1970, an extraordinary piece of evidence turned up to provide confirmation for Herodotus's account in the form of a dedication to the god Apollo at Gravisca. That's the port of Tarquinia in Etruria, and it was made by one Sostratus of Aegina. The inscription reads, "I am of Aeginetan Apollo. Sostratus made me son of..." And then, tantalizingly, it breaks off. Which is particularly unfortunate because Herodotus happens to provide us with the name of the trader's father, Leodamas, if indeed he is the same Sostratus. Well, it's likely, but it can't be proven. And if it wasn't the same Sostratus, then it might well have been the grandson, because it was the practice in the Greek world to name sons after grandfathers, and trades and professions tended to run in families. At all events, the man who made the dedication was one of a number of Greek merchants who were trading with the Etruscans in luxury goods in the late 6th century. It's thought that Sostratus probably used the Deolcus at Corinth, the town situated at the point where the Peloponnese divides off from the rest of the Greek mainland. The Deolcos was a stone trackway which enabled ships to be towed across the isthmus between the Saronic and Corinthian gulfs, instead of having to circumnavigate the Peloponnese. It was probably built by the Corinthian tyrant Periander around 600 BC, and it remained in use until the 9th century AD. Though prejudice towards those whose livelihood derived from trade diminished around 600, I doubt that it completely disappeared. In Athens, for instance, a century and a half later, much of the trade was conducted by metics, resident aliens, who lived in the port city known as the Piraeus, about 5 miles southwest of Athens. And Athens, as a maritime power, was extremely active in trade in the 5th and, to a slightly lesser extent, the 4th century BC. According to Thucydides, Pericles boasted that, I quote, "all the produce of every land comes to Athens." And this is echoed by another historian. We don't know his real name, but he's been dubbed Pseudo-Xenophon, who reports, I quote, "whatever desirable commodity is available in Sicily, Italy, Cyprus, Egypt, Lydia, the the Black Sea region, the Peloponnese, or anywhere else is brought to Athens. Athens's biggest import, however, was grain, her need for which greatly exceeded that of any other state in the classical period. Most of it came from the Black Sea region, but she also imported from Egypt, Libya, Cyprus, Phoenicia, Sicily, and the Po Valley in northern Italy. Her most valuable export was silver. Prejudice towards traders was based in part on their close kinship with pirates. And speaking of this widespread phenomenon in antiquity, Nicholas Purcell writes, "The Mediterranean seaways offered a world of opportunity and danger in which legality was tenuous and violence normal." The first references to pirates appear in the Homeric poems, particularly in the Odyssey. Although it was hardly the most respectable profession, pirates were accepted in polite society. Odysseus himself carries out seaborne raids, which might appropriately be categorized as piratical. Piracy continued to flourish in the classical and Hellenistic periods. The abduction of a young man or woman by pirates became a stock theme in the Greek novel. Let's now turn to the Hellenistic period. As a result of the conquests of Alexander the Great, many new cities were founded in the east, and this meant that trade now began to look towards the east. One of the principal beneficiaries of this change was the island of Rhodes, which is situated in the eastern Aegean, just 11 miles from the Turkish coast. Rhodes was ideally located to facilitate trade with the east, and it possesses no fewer than 5 harbours. It became the centre for what is called transit trade. That's to say, it was a place where ships could dispose of their wares and purchase others in replacement, instead of having to sell them piecemeal in a variety of locations. Greek trade wasn't limited to the Mediterranean basin. Greek goods, particularly pottery, have been found in Britain, France, Sweden, Switzerland, Bavaria, and Russia. We'll talk next about trade in the Mediterranean in Roman times. Certainly, the Roman aristocracy, like its Greek counterpart, exhibited publicly a lofty disdain for all commercial activities. Regarding agriculture as the only appropriate source of wealth for the true gentleman. But this was something of an affectation. Commercial undertakings were in the hands of the negotiatores, literally the people who negotia gerunt, the people who conduct business deals. And many of them were men of considerable wealth and standing in Roman society with the rank of knight, the so-called equestrian class, the equites. And of course, the aristocracy benefited from their commercial undertakings because they needed markets for their produce. Besides, even if there were some crusty old Romans who turned up their noses at trade elsewhere in the empire, the olfactory nerve may not have been quite so sensitive. And it goes without saying, the Roman Empire would have fallen apart without trade. From marine archaeology, we know that the number of shipwrecks in the Mediterranean antiquity reaches its peak in the period from 100 BC to AD 300, and the total is not equaled again until the High Renaissance. Incidentally, one of the most famous shipwrecks involves St. Paul, whose ship was blown by a gale halfway across the Mediterranean before foundering on the rocks of Malta. The large number of shipwrecks suggests a very high level of trading activity. How could it not have been? Cities like Rome, with a population of about 1 million, provided enormous markets. Its annual caloric intake was ginormous. The historian Lionel Casson has calculated that Rome had to import 135,000 tons of grain annually from Egypt. Egypt was known as the breadbasket of Rome because it supplied most of the city's grain. Ships 180 feet long, capable of transporting 1,200 tons or more of grain, plied the route. Second reason, Roman trade tariffs represented a very low percentage of the overall value of the import, though more was charged on imports from outside the empire. And so this would have acted as a further incentive to trade. Under the Romans, a high degree of regional specialization evolved. Syria, for instance, exported textiles and glassware. Egypt produced grain, jewelry, and perfumes. France specialized in wine and pottery. And trade was not limited to the boundaries of the Roman Empire. Spices, ivories, and other luxury items were imported from the east coast of Africa and from India. There's also evidence of trade, albeit indirect, with China for the first time in history. Even so, piracy continued to exist in the Roman world and wasn't really finally brought into control until the first century BC, when Pompey the Great in 67 BC at least limited the areas of the Mediterranean open to piratical activity. 2 years previously, pirates had sacked the island of Delos, which had been an important center for transit trade for nearly a century. Even in the reign of the Emperor Augustus, however, there were still pockets of piratical activity, and later the Roman emperors did manage to control most of the coastline around the Mediterranean, but they never eliminated it altogether. After all, the Mediterranean is a very large area of water to control. And when the empire began to disintegrate in the 5th century, then piracy made a comeback. The Vandals were particularly active as pirates operating from Carthage, which they used as a base for their seaborne raids. Next, I want to turn to the land. Once goods arrived on land, for the most part, they had to be hauled. The only navigable rivers of any size that flow into the Mediterranean are the Nile and the Rhone. The Rhone, which flows through Switzerland and France, enters the Mediterranean at Marseille, which was itself a Greek colony founded around 600 BC. Julius Caesar captured it in 49 BC in the civil war against Pompey, and thereafter, Marseille lost its commercial importance, though it continued to be a center of Greek culture and learning. From the 3rd century BC onwards, vessels would have transported goods up the Tiber from the port of Ostia to Rome, a distance of about 14 miles. But it wasn't until the reign of the Emperor Trajan, that's to say AD 98 to 117, that the harbor at Ostia was made completely safe from storm. Greece was not so well served. None of its rivers is navigable, and only a few have estuaries wide enough to serve as ports. So, goods destined for Athens had to be transported by cart from the port of Piraeus, a distance of about 5 miles, as we've seen. And this meant that throughout the Mediterranean, once on land, both people and goods moved about either on road or on track, a track being merely a well-trodden or not-so-well-trodden path. The most common means of transporting goods over land was by the two-wheeled cart or the four-wheeled wagon, both of which had been invented by the 3rd millennium BC. For the most part, wagons and carts were pulled by oxen, especially if the load was heavy. Well, the top speed of an ox is about 1.5 miles an hour, and the maximum distance that an ox can travel in a day is about 11 miles, so you easily get the sense of a rather slow-moving economy. And when something racier was required, teams of mules and donkeys were used instead. In the Greek world, most roads were local, being designated to facilitate travel within a state's territory. They didn't serve the purpose of joining separate communities to one another. The only link between those communities were a mule or drover's tracks. It was the Romans who were the first to link up the Mediterranean with a network that covered thousands upon thousands of miles. The principle the Romans adhered to inflexibly was to build the road straight wherever possible, even when this meant tunneling through a mountain or constructing a bridge over a valley or gorge. The first major road in Italy was the Via Appia, which was begun in 312 BC. It takes its name from a prominent politician named Appius Claudius Caecus. The first stretch of it ran south from Rome to Capua, a distance of about 132 miles. It was later extended to Brundisium, modern Brindisi, in the heel of Italy. Two other major roads had been constructed by the end of the 2nd century BC, the Via Flaminia, which ran north to Ariminum, modern Rimini, on the Adriatic coast, and the Via Aurelia, which followed the western coastline. Rome's main road to the east was the Via Egnatia, which went from the Adriatic to Byzantium. It was built around 130 BC. Roman roads were built by Roman legionaries. In fact, it's been suggested that they spent more time building roads than they did fighting wars, so that's just a guess. The primary purpose, of course, was to enable Rome to dispatch their armies to a trouble spot at a moment's notice, but they also facilitated trade. So far, I've talked mainly about goods, but what about people? Lots of people were on the move. I don't just mean armies. People would travel to visit shrines, healing sanctuaries, in the hopes of a miraculous cure, visit festivals, notably those that included contests, such as the Olympic Games, or just go on holiday. The Bay of Naples was a favourite resort of rich Romans. And then there were also the tourists, soldiers, slaves, migrants, craftsmen of various kinds, all travelling, all on the move. If you were travelling by sea as a private individual, most likely you'd have to hang about on the waterfront, waiting to get a place on a ship, heading for your destination, or at least a stop-off point along the way. You'd have to take your own bedding with you, your own food, your own pots to cook with. Most people travelled on foot with a slave or two to carry their baggage because horses weren't able to travel long distances and chariots were only used over short distance. Socrates, in Xenophon's Memorabilia, talks nonchalantly of undertaking a 5 to 6 days walk from Athens to Olympia, which is a distance of about 100 miles. As a traveller in the countryside, however, you would have taken your life in your hands, as you would too if you had ventured abroad at night in a big city. As a result, the well-to-do rarely ventured out of doors unaccompanied. Just think of the killing of Laius by his son Oedipus, as described in Sophocles' Oedipus the King. Both of them refuse to stand aside, and a fight breaks out, resulting in a death. It must have happened every day, not only in the Greek world, but also in the Roman world. There's a phrase which appears with chilling regularity on Roman tombstones, "Interfectus a latronibus," killed by robbers. Well, clearly not all regions were as bad as others, and in the middle of the 2nd century AD, a Greek called Pausanias wrote a description of Greece in 10 books, travel book for tourists, describing the major monuments. And presumably, the majority of Pausanias' readers didn't fall among thieves. Inns and hotels existed, though they were often few and far between and were not particularly salubrious or even safe. I've been talking so far exclusively of the planned movement of people and goods. There was, however, another phenomenon taking place throughout the Mediterranean on a very large scale, primarily as a result of war and famine and conditions of work. The movement of peoples, even of whole populations, was a constant feature in the ancient world. In the first lecture, we saw that one of Rome's foundation myths, that of Aeneas, derives from the belief that the Romans were descendants of the Trojan refugees, and similarly the Greek myth of the Dorian invasion, based on the belief that a migratory movement occurred and unsettled a large part of the indigenous population. On numerous occasions, in the period covered by our course, human beings were being uprooted all around the Mediterranean as a result of warfare, famine, land hunger, and so on. One of the consequences of the relatively slow pace of movement throughout the Mediterranean is that information tended to travel very slowly. Major catastrophes, earthquakes, floods, tidal waves, volcanic eruptions, forest fires would have received little attention and been quickly forgotten. They just weren't newsworthy. I'd estimate that 90% of what passes for news today never reached the ears of the general public, or rather would never have travelled more than 20 miles. To conclude, we've seen that from earliest times, even as early as Neolithic times, until the early centuries of the Common Era, The peoples of the Mediterranean were busily exchanging raw products and manufactured goods. They were indefatigable travelers, as evidence stretching from Herodotus to Pausanias and beyond indicates. And finally, though this fact is often ignored by our sources, they were undergoing relocation on a level that is, to us, scarcely imaginable, even with our sobering experience of the catastrophic 20th century and beyond. In the next lecture, we'll turn to one of the best-known achievements of Mediterranean civilization, the parallel rise of democracy in Greece and of the Republic in Rome.